Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. It is Thursday evening. This is LA Talk Radio, and you are listening to The Writer's Block. My name is Jim Christine. I'm your host for the show, sitting in the studio with the lovely, vibrant, and vivacious Bobby Jean Bell. And her husband, Jim, is sitting over here and with the other set of headphones on. Good evening, James.
You can say hi, Jim.
They won't hear him.
Oh, his mic's not on.
Okay. I know, huh?
He's waving at everybody.
Hey, how was your show last week?
Oh, my gosh. It was wonderful. We had Jennifer Lind, who's a wonderful, wonderful performer. She did mostly all the music of the very prolific songwriter Randy Sparks, who started the New Christy Minstrels. She sings with that group still today. And we had a delightful evening. And your podcast of last week's show was fantastic.
Except Russ kept asking me who your guest was. I said, I don't know. I don't remember.
Well, I thought about calling in, but we just, you know, we get in that zone of doing the concert, and I, you know, sometimes I remember to call in. So,
well, we had a first last week. Our virginity and our bad language was broken. Our guest Sarita Stevens dropped the F bomb in here.
Well, we are irreverent. Doesn't it say that on the sign?
We can say anything we want.
Anything, and
it was
like
perfectly acceptable, except it was a bit of a shock. Not to say I don't ever say it.
All right, so anything goes now.
But yeah, I guess so. Okay, before we get started, I'd like to remind you that Writer's Block, that's us, is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley, California, by Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall, and by Target Freight Management in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
And we just mentioned Target Freight Management, and we like to mention them every show. And we mention them because they have a full truckload service that's the best in the industry. But have we mentioned that TFM Truckload gets your freight there every time on time? No muss, no fuss at the rates you need for your transportation bottom line. Call today at 1-844-653-7789 and tell them you heard it on The Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something extra for you. And while we're at it, if you are a LTL shipper, you are probably looking for the best rates at the lowest hassle possible. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just the ticket to getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 1-888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. Call today. You won't be sorry you did.
Yeah. Yes.
You got those numbers memorized, Jim?
I do not.
I still have to read them to make sure we get the right phone number out,
write them down. Although I do have my cheat sheet here someplace.
Well, we sure appreciate them.
We do. And I'd like to remind everybody that on the 16th of this month is our Writer's Block, Total Writer's Block show. Everybody that has anything to do with the show will be in studio. That includes the bookie, Russ, Bobby Jean, me, and of course,
Jim Mr. Bell will be along, of course.
And we're just going to have ourselves a great time that night. We can pretty much talk about anything we want to talk about, so we're not focused.
And you could call in.
And you can call in and
ask us questions.
And if you would like to do that, actually, if you'd like to call in and talk to our guest tonight, the number here is 818-602-4929. Again.
And who do we have tonight?
That number is 818. You're getting ahead of yourself. Tighten the straps. 818-602-4929. And tonight on the Writer's Block, we have a very special guest. We're just like bubbling over here.
I know.
it's like woo. And this gentleman grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I'm going to take this right off his bio because he did a really good job in this bio. He began writing at a very young age, and I'm going to guess 10, 11-ish. He became fascinated with movies as a teenager and began making them at 15, going on to New York University for college, where he studied film, TV, and radio. In New York, he worked with the comedy group The State, with PBS and several others before moving out to Los Angeles in 1995. He continued to work in the film industry for 15 years, working on various films, including a few of his own, such as the documentary The Forgotten Grave and the horror film Stolen Souls. He has more recently circled back around to book writing and has first released the critically acclaimed bestseller Pro Bono, The 18-Year Defense of Carol Ann Fugate. See, that amazes me. That just really gets my interest going. Because she was fascinating.
Oh, you know about her. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
He knows about everything.
No, not everything.
Yeah, pretty much everything. I listen to the shows again and go, oh, yeah, he said he already knew about that.
And his grandfather was her attorney.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And my father became her attorney after a while.
Oh, we got somebody. We got royalty in the house.
Yeah.
He's gone on to write novels such as The American Game and the Relic World series. He has more recently written the true crime book, The Great Heist, which introduces a character that we'll be talking about probably at length tonight, a character called Two Gun Heart. And Two Gun Heart is also a book that's a standalone. It focuses on an amazing character who is not only a successful lawman, a revenue agent, and good on God only knows what else in the Midwest, but he was also the long lost brother of Alphonse Capone.
Right.
Would you please welcome to the writer's block, Mr. Jeff MacArthur?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Great. Yeah. Oh, you're welcome.
And that actually, I started writing when I was five. I didn't actually put that on there because most of the time
that guess was wrong.
Oh, writing in his soul.
Yeah, it was something I always wanted to do. But I wanted to get into film, got distracted with that. Now I'm back to this sort of stuff, and I'm really actually glad because as a result, I got to do more with this book than I ever would have done as a movie.
Well, I have to tell you that as soon as I got the book, which was, I don't know,
probably
February,
February,
I think you sent it.
Something like that.
You and I talked about it a couple years back at the Buckaroo Bookshop at Santa Clarita, and you had missed Bobby, but you and I had spoken about it, and you told me about Two Gun Heart, and I think we were just at that point. It was the year before, but it was fascinated me then.
Yeah.
And then of course we got you booked onto the show, and I saw the book and said, I remember this guy. And I opened the book and I started reading, and it grabbed me from page one. And because my people, my people were Italian immigrants as well, so that's why it's my people.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
Her people are German.
And when I was researching the first chapter of this book, because I go into sort of Italian history at that point, the reason why that happened, the first chapter of the book is basically about Italian Americans immigrating into the U.S. And unfortunately, we weren't able to find exactly the reasons why this particular family came over. We weren't able to get the specifics, and so I was like, okay, well, let's find out why people at that time did. And I got so fascinated with that whole time. I mean, there's more than just, well, there was something that happened that went wrong, and they came over. There was this whole complicated series of events, organized crime was a big part of it. The mafia was a big part of it in Sicily, and so as a result, it was fascinating to me because it's the same stuff that had happened here was what a lot of them then ended up bringing over here,
right,
and becoming a part of over here. And so I, I got so fascinated, and I sort of overdid it in that first chapter, writing this whole history. And then I started going, oh, shoot, I got off track. I should probably change this. And it was the Capone family, the Hart family, and then a couple other people who read it who said, no, Jeff, you have to leave this.
Oh,
chapter.
Yeah, for right. sure, it, for sure.
You know. Well, I think that's one of the things that captured me immediately as an armchair historian, because it was about things I really didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And you do set it culturally and historically. So we do get all of the backstory.
Right.
I had no idea Italy's back history and the northern and southern and the different governments and being overthrown. I had no idea. You
right.
take us into the start out in
right.
the 1800s. You start to show us
right.
that whole history. And to me, that's fascinating because as a lover of the West, seeing why people come and they hit the East and they begin to move, you have to understand what was happening wherever they were coming from.
Right.
And you set it, you bring us into Brooklyn, you teach us what's going on culturally during the
right.
time period. And then, we learn that Al gets called to come to Chicago. I mean, we follow. And you introduced Bill Hart, the actor William S. Hart, near and dear to my heart, living in and working in the Newhall, Santa Clarita area, where Bill is, everything's named for him.
Yeah.
And the impact that he had on the major character of this book is also fascinating. But you show us, again, how the public was following. You give us the pop culture of the time, as well as the political and historic period. Mm-hmm. And so it reads like historical fiction, but it's not fiction. It's stranger than you couldn't
make this.
Well, I mean, when you're reading about Brooklyn, the New York area, at the first part of the 19th century, was is when they come to the country.
Right.
You can virtually see the fourth floor walk up Coldwater Flats, and you know, two rooms and eight people crammed in two rooms, and but that's how they lived.
Yeah,
right.
So. Did you have something?
I was going to put an addendum on there, but this is why we like people in the studio. So we get to argue openly.
I'll be the arbitrator.
But you also get to see the rise and the success of his father.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because as he gets more successful, of course, they keep moving into nicer and nicer and nicer place.
Right.
So that also was never brought out before.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that was so exciting about putting this together, this is the first book that the Capones were actually actively, you know, helping get information for and all that sort of thing. And this, they actually went back, some of the Harts went back to Italy, and it was the very first time any of the Capones actually returned to Italy since 1895 when they originally left. And so they were able to go back and reconnect with the Capones, because not all the Capones left. There were still Capones left in Italy. So they reconnected, and it was like sort of a historical, you know, event. And as a result, they were able to get all this new information. I have photographs of like the...
Great photographs.
Where they lived. And that was from them, because they just went back there, photographed the apartment where they lived back in Angri, Italy. And all of this information, including the father's rides, we were able to learn so much of this stuff from that.
Yeah, and you learn about Al and the Five Points Mob and all those guys and how he rose and his power.
The main character in this book is the eldest son of the Capone family.
Vincenzo.
Mm-hmm. And there are nine children altogether. And Alfonso, Al, is number four.
I believe that's right.
I think he's number four.
Yes.
So tell us, because we're just so excited, it's so hard to try to figure out what to talk about.
Vincenzo is number one.
He's number one.
Right. Yeah, and his American name is James.
Yeah,
right.
I have this list here. Number two is known as Ralph Bottles Capone, Raffaella James also. Number three is Salvatore Frank Capone. Number four is Alphonse. Number five is Erminio or John.
Mm-hmm.
Number six is Albert or Umberto.
Wow.
Number seven is Matthew or Amedeo. I don't know how to pronounce that.
Amedeo. Yeah.
And number eight is Ermina, who dies as an infant, one of the two daughters. And number nine is Mafalda.
Mafalda, correct.
Who marries John Maritote.
I think it's Maritote.
Now, before we I know we want to get into more sort of details, but tell us about Richard Hart.
Okay.
And his relationship with Al.
Okay, well, yeah, initially Vincenzo Capone, he's born in Italy, comes over with the family, and, you know, like you said, the fourth son is Al, and he winds up being pretty close to him, actually. He winds up being sort of a mentor to him. And one of the things that I found very touching about this story was, as Al was growing up, one of his favorite activities was going to Staten Island with this older brother, Vincenzo. And they'd go over, and there was this ice company that had a bunch of mules and horses and ponies. And he would ride around, and one of Al Capone's favorite things to do was riding on this horse. And the reason why Vincenzo would go over there, he always had this love of the Old West. He had the love of riding horses and, you know, all that sort of thing. And in fact, that's why he was so taken with William S. Hart, who was doing theater at the time, and in fact had done an entire production. He was in a production of...
Ben-Hur.
Ben-Hur, thank you, which actually had live horses on the stage, you know, all that sort of thing. Anyway, so he would take Al out there. But then there's one day he goes down. He goes down to the ferry and he goes, "Not today, Al." Al's like, I think 10 or 8.
Yeah, 10 or 11.
Yeah, something like that. And he says, "You know, not today. You're staying here." gets on the ferry, rides away, and I just picture Alphonse watching his oldest brother go off on the ferry, and he doesn't see him again. That he just disappeared.
Well, for at least 50 years, doesn't
right.
see him
well,
again.
Well, actually, for a number, it wasn't quite yeah. 50, but it was, yeah, it was yeah. a while.
And Al was already at that age. He starts like 8 or 9. He's already yeah. kind of getting into it
with the other brother.
Leaning a little towards, you know, not yeah. so nice activities.
Right. Well, that was the two brothers between that you were mentioning.
Yeah, the two brothers
Salvatore
are in between.
And Raphael were mm-hmm. getting very mm-hmm. much into these gangs, and they were kind of the influence in that direction, and Vincenzo was the influence in the other direction. Mm-hmm. But as a teenager, Vincenzo runs away from home, joins the circus, or joins the Wild West show,
right.
and disappears, and, you know.
And that's the, is that the Miller 101?
Yeah,
that's when he joins
Miller
the Miller 101.
101.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
we,
yeah, which is famous. Oh, my
yes.
gosh. Bill
Huge.
Pickett was part of that.
Huge.
And oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it, what it technically is that he disappeared. We don't really know for certain, but then he reappears. The next time we see him, he's in the 101 Ranch. We assume he joined that and like
okay.
went with them.
Right, right.
But, yeah.
And then he winds up in the Army in World
yeah,
War I.
Yeah,
right.
yeah. So he was with Pershing.
Right.
So he tell us about that exploit.
Well, he ends up joining the Army while in the Midwest, touring around and all sort of thing. And actually, the first place, he winds up in the punitive expedition down in Mexico.
Right.
And I always remember that because when I discovered that at like 2 in the morning, just was so blown away. Oh, my God, my girlfriend jumped out of bed thinking that, you know, the place was on fire or something like that. And I'm like, he was in the punitive expedition. And she
yes,
was,
but his name was not,
right,
it was not Hart and it was not Capone at
yeah,
that point.
Right.
He had another name.
Yep.
Yeah, he had another name.
Exactly. And the only way we were able to find out was we found out what unit he joined, and then I had to just follow that unit and where it went. And that's why I then discovered where he had gone. But yeah, at 2 in the morning, then my girlfriend's like, what in the hell is the punitive expedition? But so he winds up in World War I, is decorated as a, oh, I forget, I was just looking at what the medal was. But
a silver star?
Something like that.
Sniper.
By General Pershing himself. I mean, the photograph is actually of General Pershing himself,
right.
personally putting the medal. And if anybody doesn't know, Pershing was like the top general.
Right.
You know, and so it would be like you putting like Eisenhower putting a pin on somebody. It was this huge deal. And then next, you know, when the war ends, he then comes back and goes to the Midwest.
Now, what was the reason that he changed his name before he enlisted? I mean, because there was nothing wrong with the Capone name at
right.
that point.
At that point, there was nothing specific about the Capone name, but there was a lot of racism against Italians.
Oh, God. And, oh, right, right. Okay.
And that was, yeah.
That was the point there. Yeah.
Exactly.
Changes the right.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so then, but when he comes back, he changes his name again.
Exactly.
Right.
He changes it. That's when he changes it to Richard Hart, and that's where what he stayed with from then on.
Right.
And he moved to Nebraska. Actually,
right.
he moved to the Midwest, and he was taking a train. And it almost seems random that he just sort of jumped off the train in Homer, Nebraska, this little tiny town.
Right.
Although I've always suspected that Pershing may have said something about Nebraska, because Pershing was known for loving Nebraska. He had lived there for a while and sort of thing. So I think that he may have said something. But anyway, so he jumps off and just sort of randomly, and he basically wanted to live like a cowboy. And he gets there and finds that, well, nobody's really living like a cowboy anymore. People are driving cars and all that. But he's like, no. I'm going to live like a cowboy, and he starts, you know, dresses up like one,
right,
rides
right.
a horse.
Yeah, he's inspired
his boots,
by
his two
Bill
guns,
Hart.
His 10-gallon hat.
He's got the hearts on his boots.
Yeah.
It's just
fabulous. Yeah.
And
came up with one hell of a backstory for himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, started referring to himself as half Indian, half, you know, we're not 100% sure if he said half Mexican or half Indian, but anyway.
From Oklahoma.
From Oklahoma,
right.
Yeah. And, just basically started making up a different kind of life for him. And at that time, you didn't have an ID from a specific place. So everybody just took him at his word.
Right, right.
He was incredibly talented. He played all kinds of instruments.
Right. Yes.
He picked up language.
Oh,
he learned several Native American languages over the years, which is not an easy thing.
No.
Oh, yeah.
He, of course, is a pugilist, and, you know, he knows how to protect himself.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I found fascinating was the whole Capone family was very musical. If they hadn't gone into crime, they could have been like one of those musical families.
Could have had their own band.
Yeah. In fact, while Al...
The Capone Five.
Our baseball team.
Yeah. When Al was in prison, he actually started a band of these very infamous criminals until they all started fighting with each other and using the instruments to beat each other with. And so then they had to stop. But he played the banjo.
Yeah.
Well.
Well, you're only going to clunk somebody once with the banjo.
With the banjo.
But yeah, he, and like you say, with the languages, once he actually became a prohibition agent and then a BIA agent, he started working with several Native American tribes, including the Omaha and the Winnebago. And he would learn their languages first. And, I mean, first of all, he spoke fluent Italian, then, of course, fluent English, and then he learned these different languages and their cultures. So you have all these times when he was working with them. They loved him because he didn't just go in there and go, okay, well, this is what you're going to do. He learned their culture and then learned how to speak with them.
You know, Bill Hart is part of his background, of course, is several connections tied to Native American communities as well. Do you think that that was partly what inspired him to follow that? Yeah, I do.
Unfortunately, he never actually said all of, you know, where all these influences came from. But, you know, especially as I was reading William S. Hart's own memoir and like all this information about him. And in fact, Richard even worked at one of the places where William S. Hart had grown up near the Pine Ridge Reservation. And so I can't help but think he was partially influenced by him. But also, actually, it was interesting. Richard's grandson was talking about how he believes that because he came from Italy and because he had experienced so much of the racism from his own past, that he kind of understood where a lot of where they came from, and he understood that language affects so much of who you are and, you know, and how you think, and that's why he would learn these languages, because in learning their language, he would come to understand how they thought more. Mm-hmm. And then he could work with them a lot more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what did he just say?
So he lands in Homer, and he begins work as a lawman along the line.
Exactly. First, he was just doing odd jobs and all that sort of thing, and he really wanted to be a sheriff. He wanted to be like, you know, like in the movies, but there just weren't any. It was a little tiny town. But then Prohibition comes along.
Right.
Actually, before that comes along, real quick, he saves a girl from a flood. And he saves her family from the flood, and they end up marrying
Catherine.
Kathleen. Anyway,
read the book.
Unfortunately, that's the thing about being a writer is by the time you're interviewed, you're already on to researching the next book.
Right, right.
You're doing great.
Kathleen is her name. Anyway, he saves her whole family from a flood, including her and. And they end up marrying like a few months later. So he's already living like this cowboy lifestyle. And then Prohibition comes along, and that's where they can get new law officers.
Right.
And he takes it, and he goes so above and beyond the call of duty. He actually becomes more successful in 1920 than, you know, nobody knew of Al Capone in 1920.
Right.
But the name Richard Hart was actually quite famous, and he went around and broke up more stills than anybody else, all that sort of thing. Until he started seeing so much corruption. My favorite story, I'll keep it real brief, but basically he's like taking somebody, at one point he sometimes would use a car when, you know, capturing some people, and he's taking somebody, gets lost, ends up going to the wrong town, and instead of going, oh, we went the wrong way, goes going the other direction, he goes, someone out here must be selling alcohol.
Right.
So he goes out, he finds the guy selling alcohol, punches him, knocks him out in one punch, drags him over to where the deputy is, and he goes, okay, show me the sheriff, I want to, you know, I'm going to arrest him. And the deputy just points of the man he just
knocked out.
And then, so that's the sheriff, and tries to arrest him, and he ends up escaping with his.
The book is just filled with these kind of stories.
I know, it's just great.
And how, you know, he did a lot of work at night because he knew how to look for, he knew what to look for, and so he'd look for the little lights that are on in unusual places, and he knew how to look for the elements that you needed to make a still.
And
the
smell.
And just absolutely fascinating. Some of those stories, how did you, did family share those, or did he keep notes that you read, or was it, you know, how did you find,
you know,
the nuts of this book?
The hardest part is that the last thing he never did. He even stayed with the the whole persona in that he was the strong silent type, and he wouldn't tell anybody. He wouldn't, you know, he didn't keep any diary, all that sort of thing. So it was so difficult finding a lot of these things. So it was typically, first of all, you know, newspaper reports, because he loved newspaper reports. That was the one thing, is he really was trying to get, you know, anybody's information or anybody to write about him as he could. He even was, it's believed that he actually wrote some himself and sent them into the newspapers, all that sort of thing. It was interesting that you bring up the night one, though, because I do remember that one I found later, and I don't remember where exactly, but there were some of them that I that the way that I found was this sort of some obscure thing later on where somebody years later was writing, because what he did a lot of times in his later years, we sat around and played cards, and to those guys, like the other guys around the card table, he would tell some things to, and so you later had to learn. And it was one thing that was kind of heartbreaking at the release party of this in Homer, Nebraska. Some people came up to me and told me some stories. I'm like, I'd love to have that in the
so volume two, more stories of Richard Hart. What did you find as you were researching him? What did you find most compelling?
Boy, oh my God, that's a great question. That is one of those things where it's like, you ask on different days, and I'll probably have different answers, but here's the one that I have right now, is how similar he and Al were. Because we all know about Al and how successful he was at what he did, because he just went in full gusto. And yet here is this brother who was away from him, was not influenced, throughout his life, but just by nature became just as successful and had just as much drive and energy to do what he was going to do, even though it was literally exactly the opposite side of the law. Mm-hmm.
You know what I found amazing, though, was the fact that the more work he did, the less money he made.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I just found it unconscionable that he would do all of this for the state and for the federal government, and he virtually made pennies.
Right. Well, in fact, his family wound up in a box down by there's that.
They were destitute.
Yeah, there's a SNL skit of down by the river, but they literally were living in a box,
right?
Because the government basically abandoned them, and in the I guess we're doing a little bit of a spoiler alert later on, but he ended up living off of the Capone family purely because after he did all this amazing work for both the Prohibition offices and the BIA. He ended up just poor and destitute during the Great Depression and having to live off of his family.
Right.
Well, and there were times that whoever he was working for, he'd be assigned somewhere. They'd run out of money and he'd work for free. He'd say, I don't want to stop doing this.
Right.
I'll just keep working until you pay me.
Well, that's dedication.
Yeah.
They abandoned him in Boise.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah.
What a place to get abandoned.
exactly. Well, what happened is he caught, skipping way ahead in the years, but he ended up catching his boss. Well, doing two things, actually. One of them was, helping the very people they were supposed to be fighting, but also cheating on his wife, which at the time, the second was the most scandalous. But he wasn't able to prove it. And so Richard was the one who ended up getting fired.
Right.
Well, after he ended up getting fired and leaving and all that, it was found that both of them were true of the other guy, and he ended up having to leave.
They never gave him anything back.
Right, exactly. You would think that the Prohibition Office would be like, I forget the full name, but the Office of Prohibition Affairs or whatever would go like, our bad, you were right, or the BIA or somebody would say, hey, you've been such a good officer. Turns out you were right about all this. Here's your job back. But instead they wouldn't. And then he ended up working in secret because he was like working as a filing clerk for one of the places. He would see in the files where they were making mistakes, and he's like, this is what you should do. And they kept going,
no,
you should do this wrong. Yeah, well, he kept telling them what they should do. They do it wrong. He'd go, I'll just go and do it. Just don't tell anybody. And he goes and does it. And when they found him, they forced the office he was working for to fire him. So it's just, it's so absurd.
Yeah, he just, he was horrible at paperwork.
Yeah.
Now we know how he got from Brooklyn to Nebraska. How did Al get from Brooklyn to Chicago and Cicero?
Oh. Yeah, that's a whole man. That basically once the positive influence had left, he did fall in with the other brothers. Ended up kind of working with this group of sort of street thugs. Note about them. One of my favorite stories about them as a kid was. At one point, when he and his friends, like at 10 years old or something like that, started a racket with the Shoeshine Boys.
Right.
They ended up threatening this kid who runs into a bar where a bunch of his friends are to protect him. And these guys come out from the bar to chase them, and they do like the Bugs Bunny bit. They're like, they went this way, and they start chasing a ghost along with the other people. They're all running a certain way. They just fall in with them, started chasing them, and that's how they got away.
It's like, shh, I'm hunting wallets.
Yeah. But yeah, there's some people who just before this had published a book about Al's youth, so I was able to put in a lot of that. But basically, he ended up To make a long story short, he wound up working with this person named Johnny Turio, who moved out to Chicago, and essentially as Prohibition came along, they're like, hey, this is going to be a really good racket. We can make a lot of money. You come out here, this is going to be a fresh start. Al, at the start, this is actually one of the things that really surprised me about Al, was it really appears, and there's enough evidence that I believe it, that he actually at the time, just before Prohibition, was actually trying to pull away from it. He had just gotten married. He had just had a kid. And he was seeing that, like, you know what, this is going to be dangerous. And it just so happened his father died right then. And according to Italian tradition, when the father dies, the oldest son is supposed to take over.
Who's not there?
It's Vincenzo. He'd run away as a teenager. Ralph and Salvatore were both being very, at that particular time, were both being really irresponsible and really just didn't have anything, they could barely take care of themselves, let alone the family. So Al took it upon himself, and he said, but I don't have enough money to take care of my family and my mother and all that, doing the job I'm doing. So, okay. So he took Torrio's offer and went to Chicago, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
We have a story in our family, and I'm wishing now that I really could remember it. It was just a little story, but my grandmother on my dad's side, my dad's mom, the last name was Berkmeyer, and she remembered as a young girl, and they lived in the Chicago area, neighbors that would just pack up in the middle of the night and be gone. And then they'd come back like 2 weeks later, and they were members of the Capone family. I don't know that they were necessarily Al Capone's family, but there was always raids. It would always happen. Then they'd read in the paper, about some kind of a raid, and the family would just pack up and go. And it was always in the middle of the night, and they could hear drawers, like the dresser drawers slamming shut, and doors opening and closing, and lots of noises, they would be leaving.
Fascinating.
Well, they probably used to go down to the hotel. And move in there for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, probably.
Because if this is, the 1920s. I mean, funny enough, it could even be later on because the federal authorities continued to kind of harass the Capone family for years afterwards, even though they got out of the rackets after Al went to prison.
Right.
I mean, one of the brothers, Ralph, actually ended up staying, continuing to have a lot of influence, but they actually broke free of the of that whole lifestyle. But yeah, the federal authorities continued to like chase after them, thinking that they were continuing to run something under the table.
So did Al and Richard ever meet?
There is the they did definitely meet, but when they first met is the big sticking point, the big question.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
It's not even a spoiler alert. You'll notice in the book, I talk about this person claims this, this person claims this, this person. I did this because the feelings and the opinions are so strong. Everybody has their own. If you ask, even among the Harts, you ask the oldest one, he's like, "Didn't happen until such and such a date." Then you ask the next one, he's like, "Well, I think it happened at this date." And they ask the next one, "I think it happened at this date." Yeah. You ask me, I honestly think that they met up in 1924. When there was this, there's a reporter who has a lot of credibility. His whole life, he died in the 90s.
I'm amazed that he made it like through his whole life and didn't get rubbed out because he was well respected by the family, even though he was right. I mean, it was that was very interesting.
Yeah. It's I forget his name, but yeah, there was a
Beraldi, something like that. Beraldi.
Yeah. In fact, the famous photos of the St. Valentine's Day massacre were his photographs. So this is a guy who was a favorite of Al's, and he got inside information, all that sort of thing. Well, he claimed later on that he actually saw them get together in 1924. Now, the ones who don't believe that, or who say it wasn't until later, just simply don't believe him. They say no, but then there were reports from members of the Omaha and the Winnebago tribes who claimed that it was soon after that. It was like sometime during the 1920s.
It was on their reservation.
And he says they would see them together meeting, and they'd be like, why is Al Capone talking with our Prohibition agent?
Strange bedfellows.
Right, get together and talk.
So I know we need to get to some process questions.
We do.
So we do.
We need to put Al Capone to rest for a few minutes.
Because this is a great book, and it is so exciting. You just get excited by the subject matter here. But we know that on this show, we do like to talk about process.
We do. We talk about process.
Oh, okay.
The book we're talking about right now is Two Gun Heart, written by Jeff MacArthur. And it's a great read. If you haven't read it, please pick it up and read it, and because it is really worth your time. As we've been talking about tonight.
It's fascinating.
We always like to ask about your process when you're writing. Your background, how you do your research. your day, what's your writing day like?
Okay.
And go from there.
Okay. Well, actually, all of those are a little bit different, especially because there's kind of a difference between, writing nonfiction and fiction. In fact, actually, I usually give a visual. Unfortunately, it won't come across in radio, but I describe the difference between nonfiction and fiction is and I kind of lean forward and, look as if I'm reading a book. Or I'm sorry, nonfiction is leaning forward and, reading. Fiction is, and I lie back and just act like I'm resting. My girlfriend one time came in and saw me just, lying down. She's like, boy, I wish I was a writer. I'm like, I'm writing. But that's, because of the thing is when you're doing nonfiction, it's to me the process is just completely different. Since we're talking about Two Gun Heart, I'll go into that. Essentially, to me, it's a matter of I don't sit down and write. Like right now, I'm writing something about soldiers during the Vietnam War, American and South Vietnamese, and I'm not going for any chapters, any of the specifics. I'm literally just going, okay, give me whatever information you can. Just soak it. I would want to jump into this like I jump into a pool. Just soak it all in, and I'll just basically get the basic information. Then once I have this whole big pool, then I kind of get a sense of the formation of it, and I make that form through chapters. And I go, okay, chapter one is this, chapter two is it. Now, I have to always understand that that's going to be malleable. The book that goes along with this, The Great Heist, got changed so many times. Like, up until publication, I was changing chapters around. But basically, to at least give myself a direction, I go, okay, chapter one is going to be this. And in this case, it was like, chapter one, how they got to the U.S. Chapter two, their life in Brooklyn. Chapter three, his life on the road, et cetera, et cetera. And then that way I can chew it in pieces, because when you try to go after everything, it's just too much. I mean, at first I kind of go after everything because I just give me everything. But then once I can focus on something, once I go, okay, I am right now researching his time as the probation, or actually more specific one, his time with the on the road with the 101 show. So that way, that's all I have to do. That's all I have to research. I'm not, it's like nothing else exists. I'm only concentrating on that. And once I get all that information, then I kind of put it in chronological order, or at least the order I'm going to write it in, and I just go, okay, and take this, that sort of a thing.
Okay. That's a fair answer.
That's fair. And now you also blog. Mm. You write great, great blogs.
Thank you.
And they're lengthy.
Thank you.
I mean, there's real content there. It's not just had a great day today. And I mean, it is gems content.
Thank you.
I read just the blogs from probably the last three or four entries, and you had quite an experience at WonderCom recently.
Yeah.
And you really gave great ideas there for, if you're going to go show there.
Thank you.
So how do you decide what you're going to blog about and set aside the time for blogging?
Oh, man, that is a great question. That is like the million-dollar question, because one of the things that Jamie, I just give her name, my girlfriend Jamie, hears me complain about a lot is how the heck am I going to write these blogs? And she's even telling me, Jeff, you don't need to write a whole big, long, because to me, I always feel like, what's the point of reading something if I'm just going to hear, hey, I ate cupcakes today? I'm not going to Twitter because of that. I don't, it's like I want to actually, if I'm going to speak, I want to be speaking about something. So I want to give something that's real information. So I'll be like, okay, I'll just write this. This will be two paragraphs. 3 pages later, I'm like, okay, I better wrap this up. But that's, so basically in terms of finding things, I have several different blogs to match, and I have to really focus them on one thing. But I have something about my Relic World, which is my science fiction series, and then one about just writing in general, and one about my experiences as a filmmaker. But basically, based on what it is I'm writing, I'm now trying to focus just on myself as the writer in terms of blogs. Basically, whatever is going on at that moment that I can see might be helpful. I try not to write anything that won't be helpful to people. I just feel like that's a waste. Although they tell you're supposed to come up with something every week, I have difficulty with that, not only in writing it, but in terms of finding something that will actually be relevant. So there's a lot of times I skip a week just purely because I'm like, I want it to be relevant or helpful.
One of the places we're talking about is his Blogspot blog at Jeff MacArthur Author. MacArthur author .blogspot.com, and you wrote two parts on the secret of independent publishing.
Oh,
part one and part two, and it's exactly the kinds of topics that we love to talk
Absolutely.
About here.
Oh,
while we're talking about that for just a moment, you do some positives and negatives about should you self-publish or not, and you have been self-published. What do you love about self-publishing?
Well, I see it as very much like the film industry in that, you know, we don't bat an eye when we hear about an independent film. We don't sit there and go, oh, it's a self-published film. Or even on YouTube, we don't go self-published, you know, so it's like, why should it be different here? It's very much the same thing as where you have the major publishing or the traditional publishing is like the studios, in that what you have is a large group of people and their interest is in making money. Now, that's not to say they create bad stuff. There's a lot of great books created by the major publishers, just like there are some great movies made by studios. But it is made by a committee who is interested in, you know, that's their goal. Whereas independent publishing, your goal is your passion about this project. You want to make sure it's done exactly the certain way and all that sort of thing. And as a reader, you have to understand that's what you're going to get. I mean, either one could be more credible or less credible, but you just have to understand where they're coming from. As a person saying to, you know, whether or not somebody should self-published or, you know, and independent, but I actually prefer that phrase myself, independent publish, versus go through a major, and I'm glad you guys say that. By the way, thank you so much for having independently published people on here, because there's so many places that won't. But, you know, as for which one should do, I say that, you know, use the exact same question. If you were going to make it into a movie, would you go to a studio and have all the backing of all the promotions and advertising and all that sort of thing? Or are you going to go the smaller route where you're not going to have as many people, but you are going to get it done exactly the way you want
right,
it to be done?
Right, right. So, you know, we believe in independent publishing here, because I would say good half of the authors that we have on board are independently published. And they present us with some damn good work.
Absolutely. And most of them, though, go ahead and hire an editor or, you know,
right. We
read a lot of books that come across that you sometimes can kind of tell right away. Mm-hmm. There's some telltale signs. For me, it's even about layout and the font that's chosen and just different things like that. And I often will feel if I see, because you did have an editor for Two Gun Heart. I think you had two editors, actually.
We did.
So it has the tightness of what one might anticipate from a traditional publisher, where I find sometimes a lot of what's independently published is it needed editing.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And that's why I say to readers that are reading, it's like, just like you go on YouTube, there are some phenomenal programs on YouTube, but you're going to eventually, you know, every now and then you're going to see some mistakes or it's going to be rough around the edges and all that sort of thing. But you accept that to get something that is so pure that they wouldn't accept it on... Sorry, there's a train going through.
There is a train going through.
but you accept it because, you're basically wanting to get something that you know the studio would never do because it's not going to be profitable enough. So it's like, okay, I accept these little rough around the edges moments, and you're going to see that with some of the books as well. And, you know, it's like, just understand that it's not that people are being lazy. It's just, But yeah, and as the publisher, you have to understand that too. With this one, we went above and beyond because we knew this was going to be a bigger deal. But with certain other ones, it's, you know, maybe a little bit rougher.
I think when you're independently published, also you have to shamelessly self promote.
Yes.
And that is one thing that you either do or you don't do. And if you don't do, you're not going to sell any books.
Right.
And
right.
I can honestly say that I think we have put a lot of books out there where people have read them that have never would have.
Right. Yeah, well, in fact, that's, again, why I really, really appreciate that you guys are doing this, because, I mean, there are so many places where I'll go to and they won't even look at what I'm writing because, it's self-published, so therefore we won't touch it. And I'm kind of like, by the way, and I should explain, why I actually did go for traditional publishing in this because, again, I'm a big proponent of independent publishing. But, you know, just like an independent filmmaker will sometimes make a studio piece, I was going to do my studio piece, and this was going to be it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it deserves much bigger promotions and all that sort of thing. But I went to 100 different agents, and I got turned down by all of them. And the ones who got back to me, they told me, and I kid you not, this is exactly what they said, it's about an Italian-American who's not a gangster, so therefore we're not interested.
It's just like... bigotry.
That's dumb.
You know, that's just so not appropriate.
We have a caller.
Oh.
All right.
Hi, you're on the writer's block. Who am I speaking to? Hello?
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 Did you butt dial?
Hello?
Enter and sign in, please.
Hello?
Nope. We might hear him talking to
some
other people.
Call again.
Yeah.
Yeah, call in. Call back. Call back.
Mom, use the vote.
Okay, we need to keep moving on. Okay, yeah. Big question.
Yes.
Have you ever had writer's block?
Oh, yes, actually. That's a really good point. And is your next question going to be, how do you get over it?
No, we usually leave that up to you.
Yeah. You can just say yes and we move on, but we would like to know how you deal with it.
You know, in terms of nonfiction, I rarely have it because it's like the information's there. Either I have it or I don't. If I don't have it, I have to go research. If I do, it's like there's not much of an excuse. I mean, maybe I sometimes don't know how to put the words. And I'm actually, one thing I rely, this is a bad secret I'm revealing, maybe I shouldn't, but I rely on thesaurus.com because I, unfortunately, the words don't just pop into my head.
Yeah.
So I utilize that all the time. But yeah, that's really the most in terms of block that I have in terms of nonfiction. In terms of fiction, though, that gets really difficult. And I think one of the biggest things, that's actually what I mean by, fiction is, and then I lie down on my back, because there are times where you just need to lie down and think and let it come, or just relax.
Sure.
And take hot baths and,
sure,
go for a walk or something like that.
That's the writer's life for me.
She's calling back. Calling back. Hi, you're on the writer's block. Who are we speaking to?
Hey, it's Eric Heisner. How you doing,
Jim?
Hey, Eric. How are you, buddy?
Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Eric. Welcome to the writer's block. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, I got to call in on Al Capone's brother.
Oh, cool.
Very cool. My grandmother, when she was a little girl, her parents had a bar in, I think it was Berwyn or Cicero, and Ralph Capone used to come in pretty regular. And it was in the 20s. And so we said, well, what happens when, this is during Prohibition? She's like, well, if there's police around, we just put the booze away.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Eric, meet Jeff MacArthur. Jeff, this is author Eric Heisner.
Oh, hi.
And
it's great hearing your story, Jeff.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to meet you. Actually, I have a story that you might enjoy that goes along similar to the with Ralph going into a bar. One of the people who really helped me get a lot of the information was Richard Hart's grandson, and he was with Ralph one time in the 1970s, and they went to a bar together. I think it was while he was on his honeymoon or something like that. Anyway, and Ralph, they went into this bar, and Ralph's sitting there drinking, and he notices a case of some kind of, I think it's beers or some kind of liquor, sitting around, and he says, "What kind of beer is that?" Or no, he says, "Where'd you get that beer?" And the guy kind of looks a little nervous. He goes, "I got it from so and so," and Ralph just goes, just very calmly, just goes, "You're not going to get it from him anymore." And the guy, this grandson sees the guy. He says, "Up to this day, I'll never forget the look on his face." He goes, "Okay, Ralph," and didn't question anything. He just went, "Okay, Ralph." And this is the 1970s, which I found interesting.
He has spoken.
Yeah.
hey, Eric, we have you on what, next month or July, right?
July, yeah, July. Oh,
very cool. You and Al.
Yep, and we're excited about it.
And you've got a new book out that you're raising funds for. Tell us, I know we're running short on time,
really,
but
I was talking about, the between independent publishing and traditional, and there's a new one kind of in between with Inkshares.
Yes.
And it's inkshares.com. And Jeff, you've probably heard about it, but
absolutely,
it's basically you got to get to sell some pre-orders. It's kind of like crowdfunding mixed with self-publishing.
Yep.
And just tell
us. You sell the pre-orders. And then they'll give you the kind of the traditional run of publishing, but you got to make the sales first, which is it's a tough road to haul selling books that you don't have yet.
So what's the title of the book?
It's Wings of the Pirate. And it's an adventure, South Pacific adventure novel.
And you
got seaplanes and air pirates and a female archaeologist
hunting treasure.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, and our guest tonight, Jeff, he has a very briefly for 30 seconds, describe your fun.
It's similar to that. It's basically imagine Indiana Jones, but in space. It's treasure hunting. All these ancient.
Well, you definitely need to check out Inkshares because say 80% of the stuff is sci-fi related, and it's a lot of fun checking out all the different titles and a lot of good authors on there and a lot of good advice on there how to. Because every author is trying to, just like this show is promoting, it's trying to find out how to promote the titles and get it out there to the world.
Cool.
So, Eric, would somebody go to inkshares.com and then search Wings of the Pirate to find your book?
Exactly.
Okay, great.
Yep.
Cool.
And they can look it up by genres, whatever genre they're interested in. They can find, and there's different levels. People put just their drafts up there and they don't have them for pre-order yet. And you can contact the author and give them advice or tips or ask them questions. So it's a very open forum.
Great. Well, we look forward to having you in the studio next month.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it.
You and Mr. Bringus.
That's right.
Okay, thanks for calling in, Eric. I hate to cut you short, but we got to get moving.
Okay.
Take care, my friend.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
And thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, it's called Relic Worlds. I don't know if I mentioned that.
And in the time we have left, unfortunately.
It's all right.
Tell our audience where they can get a hold of you. Website, email.
Well, bandwagononline.com is where I have all my different books. My sci-fi series I was just talking about is relicworlds.com. You can find me on Facebook at Jeff MacArthur Author. And that's basically where you get. And of course, you can find all my stuff on Amazon. Just put in Jeff MacArthur, and you'll find this and all other sorts of things.
Cool beans. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us tonight on the Writer's Block. It's been a ball.
What fun.
This hour just flew by.
Yeah,
you did.
My
you did.
Goodness.
We were at 8:27 when I looked
I
at the
know.
Like, what?
Well, next week on the Writer's Block, we have Peggy Chambers. And she has written a book called The Secrets of Sandhill Island. And I'm about a little shy of half done with it. It's intriguing.
I haven't started it yet, but probably tonight.
Well, there you go. You need something to do.
Yeah.
You've been a busy girl.
Yeah.
So we're looking forward to talking to Peggy next week. She's in Oklahoma. She knows Johnny Biggs and all those guys out there.
Okay.
That pretty much ends our show for tonight. Again, Jeff, thanks for coming on.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.